Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
All right, so tonight's class, following our great controversies in Jewish history curriculum, the Hasidim and the Mitznagdim. By a show of hands, how many of you are aware of your ancestry as coming from Hasidim? A few, very nice. Anyone know definitively that you came from Mitznagdim? Litvak. You're sitting right next to each other. It's so sweet to see. It's really, that's so touching. Yes, okay, so we'll see what's going to, where all of this comes from. You know, many of the, I don't have the full curriculum in front of me right now, but many of the controversies that we've dealt with in this course, they were very clearly demarked good guys and bad guys. They were the Greeks on the one hand versus the rabbinic Jews. We had the Karaites. Is it too much of an echo? I don't know how to fix that. Moving it higher, I think I'll be too loud. Is that better or worse? Worse, right? How's that? No, I want to know about the sound. What's that? The content is not going to change now. Okay, is it okay? I don't want to do it. Yeah, fine. That's what we got. Okay, sorry. So in any case, there have been, most of the instances that we've done have been good guys and bad guys as far as the continuation, the survival of the Jewish people has been embroiled with many, many different controversies. That's not been the case for all of the controversies that we've dealt with, and it's certainly not going to be the case tonight, in which history has proven that there is a place in Torah Judaism for the Hasidim, as well as what we will still be referred to as the Mitznagdim or the Litvak. They're both good guys. And in the controversy that erupts, they're both bad guys. That's what makes it into a controversy. Because it was not necessarily a pleasant controversy. It was a very most unpleasant controversy as it went on. And history has proven itself as it has, which will go along. So let's talk a little bit about this discussion of the Hasidim and the Mitznagdim. Just before I start, there are two books which I use for tonight's class, which I highly recommend for those of you who are interested in this. One is called The Hasidic Movement and the Gaon of Vilna. The Gaon of Vilna we will discuss at length. He was one of the prime opponents of Hasidim. This is written by Elijah Judah Shochet, and it is excellent. Just an excellent, unbiased, objective approach to the two different ways of life and how they came to a head during the 1700s and early 1800s. And there's another book, of Flames of Faith, An Introduction to Hasidic Thought, written by Zev Reichman. You can take a look at both of these afterwards. If this topic interests you and you'd like to learn more about it, these are both wonderful books, and I will just be scratching the surface of what there is to discuss. Elijah Judah Shochet. The title of the second one is Flames of Faith, An Introduction to Hasidic Thought. The Hasidic movement, as we're going to begin discussing it, one disclaimer, what you see today is not what we're going to be discussing. When you think Hasidim today, so you think the Shrimal and the Longbekisha and the Beards and the Payas and the way that they act or behave in their communities, that is literally 200, 250 years into the story. The Hasidic movement broke up and splintered into dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of separate groups, each one which developed in its own way, and then Europe, the war of World War II, the Holocaust, destroyed it, and it was reborn and rebirthed. So what you see today is very different than what was. So as we're going to be discussing what was, I just want to at least make that disclaimer that the person who you're familiar with, your cousin, your colleague, the person you just see on the streets in Williamsburg, does not necessarily represent what we're going to be discussing, and that's actually part of the end story of what happened over history. But please just keep in mind that when we're talking about Hasidim, we're obviously talking about the forerunners of the person whom you see on the street, or your cousin, or your nephew, whoever it may be. But it was a different day and age, and we're going to just try to approach it from the way that the Mitznagdim dealt with it when it happened. And as often is the case in historical movements that last 250, 300 years, the way that it begins is not necessarily the way that it looks 300 years later, especially because of the fact that there are so many different groups. But let's do a little bit of the historical background, because there are four or five key events which come to a head during the 1700s, which is where we left off. If you recall, let's just go back in time a little bit and review some of the last classes that we had. Shabtai Tzvi was at what point in time? 1650s. He reveals himself in 1648, 1649, which directly coincided with the Khmelnytsky revolution in the Ukraine. That's 1648, 1649, destruction for the Jewish community of the Ukraine, total annihilation of that community. The ramifications, the reverberations of Shabtai Tzvi last easy 100 years, because the next class that we did, the Yaakov Emden and Yonatan Eibeschitz controversy, which again threw the Jewish world into a tizzy, was in 1750 is when that begins. A full 100 years after Shabtai Tzvi actually comes onto the scene, Yaakov Frank in Poland, also mid to late 1700s. So the period of the 1700s is still they're trying to rebuild the Ukrainian Jewish community, which was destroyed, and dealing with these massive movements of Shabtai Tzvi, Yaakov Frank, the ramifications, reverberations of the false messiahs, so that I could begin tonight's class with my custom, which is the 1700s was a bad century for the Jewish people. I wrote on the notes, it was an unpleasant decade. I meant century. And I feel obligated to start every century, because it's really true, because the exile has been bad for the Jewish people. We're yearning for redemption. And that was a specific time frame of dealing with Yaakov, the Emden Eibeschitz controversy, which again, as I mentioned last week, you could not avoid that. Every corner of the Jewish world was embroiled within that controversy. You had to choose sides, because it was about the leader of the Jewish world. Was he a heretic, or was he really valid? And it just destroyed communities. We're still coming off of the false messiahs themselves, the Ukrainian communities. It was another bad time. We're going to get to more things, but I had to start with that, just because it's become a running joke, and we need to perpetuate that. Number two is going to be the Russian Tsars. If you've been paying attention, we haven't really mentioned them in this class yet. They haven't been a player, even though when you think about like Jewish history and problems, they're always in the background. We always seem to be avoiding or running from the Russian Tsars, but we haven't mentioned them yet. They come onto the scene in the 1700s. Russia begins to expand eastward, taking over more lands under the reign of Peter the Great, and they become a force. As Jews begin to move eastward, the Russians are taking over westward, and what happens is the Russian nation inherits, as it begins to conquer parts of Poland, Lithuania, millions of Jews. Now the Russian Tsars, as they become more powerful, I believe they were in eastern, what's it called? The religion, Eastern, yes, thank you, Eastern Orthodox, form of Christianity, was very openly anti-Semitic. And in fact, the Russian Tsars made, when they could, Mother Russia, Judenrein. No Jew was allowed to live in Mother Russia. Forcibly expelled, they allowed them to remain in lands that Russia conquered, because that was already going to be too much to handle, but they weren't wanted there. And it was the beginning of what was known as the Jewish problem. They had a Jewish problem because they had all of these Jews that they didn't want, and they were openly anti-Semitic and openly interested in getting them out when they could. But it was haphazard. It wasn't a clear, like, this is what we're going to do. It just was haphazard. But there were Tsars who openly stated that their plan of extermination was a third of the Jews would be killed, a third would convert, and a third would just be expelled from the country. But that was their plan. So the 1700s finds the Jew now into, as they move again eastward, Russians taking over westward. Now we're going to begin to hear a lot more about the Russian Tsar as the problem, and with all of their very openly anti-Semitic policies. That's problem number two we have. Problem number three is what we'll refer to as the vices of autonomous government. The Jewish people, when they moved into Poland in the early 1300s, were actually invited in, and is often the case in exile. The first couple hundred years are often very good. It was that way in Spain. It was that way in Germany even before that. It was that way in Babylonia before that. And it was that way in Poland in the 1300s, like it is here in America. Right now, a Jew living in our day and age, would be very similar to a Jew living in Spain in 1350. You would say, is this a good place for the Jews or a bad place for the Jews? In 1350, you would say, we've been here for 350 years. We are highest class of citizen, wealthy, powerful, part of every part of society. This is a good place. And the Jew in 1350 would not believe what would happen just 40 years later, because he's living in a time where it was still good. As would the Jew in Poland in the beginning of the 13th, 14th, 1500s, it was a good place. We often, those of us who had, who had a grandmother who was Polish, who hated the Poles to her dying day more than the Germans, so we have a very different impression of Polish Jewry than what was in the beginning. 13th, 14th, 15th, 1600s was not that way. As a Jew living in America, this everything is great here. But this is a historical pattern. Things don't last forever that way because we don't belong here. I've said this to you many times. This isn't our home. We're residents here, and the divine plan is, you know, we've got lots of stops, and eventually we're not living here forever. We're going back to the land of Israel at some point. So exiles begin that way. The Jews actually refer to Poland as Polin. Polin, here we'll rest. Because they believed, as it got started, this was the place where we are going to rest until Mashiach eventually comes and brings us back. This is a good place for us. Polin. And what happened is, as the shift from under Polish government to Russian government, while they were there, they had an autonomous government. There was what's known as the Vad HaArba Aratzos, the group that led the four lands, and there was a very autonomous Jewish government that functioned throughout the lands of Poland. Now, Jewish autonomous government does not guarantee a perfect society. It would be nice if it did, but it didn't then, as it doesn't now in the land of Israel. We have a Jewish government, and it's not perfect. It's not religious, and it's not perfect. And the Vlad in Poland probably was more religious, and it also wasn't perfect. And the fact that it was run by Jews did not protect it or guarantee fairness. It did not guarantee a lack of corruption or equality amongst the classes. And when you have 300 years of a buildup of the vices, of the mistakes, of the problems, of the lack of fairness and equality, there was a tremendous buildup of resentment just from the masses, against those who were running the government. And who generally ran the autonomous Jewish government? It was the wealthy. The wealthy people ran it, as is normally the case. And the rabbis who were there had a tremendous hand as far as also having power. Most of the time that was probably good, but probably not always. And from a grassroots, from the masses, over these years, there was a tremendous amount of resentment. There was a, just as an example, there, Rabbi Wein quotes, there was a law passed by the Vad of this Arba Aratzos, of the four lands, which was that area of Europe, that a rabbi was not permitted to purchase the rabbinate. That was the law. You weren't allowed to purchase it. Now, what do you think caused that law to come into existence? Because that it tells you what society was like. This one has a wealthy father-in-law, and he wants his son-in-law to have a shteller, so he would buy, so to speak, the rabbinate. And that's the way that it went. And as much as we like to think that the shtetl in Europe was this wonderful, lovely place, it wasn't necessarily a wonderful, lovely place. There were many rabbanim who, as I mentioned last week, had 10, 15, 20 different stops along their rabbinic route, and that wasn't necessarily because they were headhunted from one place to another because they were so great. It was because there were certain people in the community who ran the community because they were the wealthy ones. And if the rabbi did or said something that they didn't like, that was the end of his employment in that particular place. And he just packed up and he went somewhere else. And so there was a certain form of leadership. And there was a tremendous amount of resentment that was built up from the masses against that form of leadership. So that also comes during this period of the 1700s, and we'll see how that's going to express itself, together with our next issue, which is D, the explosion of Kabbalah into the world of the masses. Kabbalah had existed for many, many years already. Even if we assume that when the Zohar is first published and comes into existence during the time of the Ramban in the early 1100s, but already at this point in the 16th, 1700s, it's been around for a long time, but it's no longer small groups of people who are elite scholars who are learning it. It's becoming the property of the masses. Now, the world of Kabbalah, when it's into the hands of the masses, it's a different world than even if we don't want to call somebody a rationalist, but it's a very different way of looking at the world, which is really what Kabbalah is, seeing beneath the surface. But you're entering into a world of mysticism, of angels, of devils, amulets, blessings, curses. We would today call it a superstitious world, but that was the world that was, and it was a world of the masses, and it was a world reeling from Shabtai Tzvi, who also was very Kabbalistic in nature, claiming to be the Messiah and being a miracle worker. And that was the flavor of the world. Just as an example, there was, I'm sure many of you are aware of the fact, there are many Mishulachim who are here this particular week. I think there were 9 or 10 traveling around. One of them, who happened to be a Sephardi guy, many of the Sephardim also were very into the world of Kabbalah spread to the Sephardim. Told me the following, he stopped me, he was here in the Kollel, he stopped me, he says, Rabbi, I have to tell you one story. And so I end up hearing the story. And I was in the midst of preparing this, and it was such an insight into a world that I, as spiritual as I think of myself, have trouble relating to. And he tells me, he rolls up his sleeve, and he shows me a huge scar, you know, from his wrist all the way up to his elbow. And he explains to me that he was in the army in Eretz Yisrael. I'm sure I'm going to mess up some of these details. And some accident had happened, and he had had a major issue, and he needed a surgery on his arm, and they had opened him up, and they did the surgery. And 6-12 months later, he was having major problems again, serious pain, and the doctors told him he needed to have a second surgery to fix that which had happened, that the ligaments or the bone had not appropriately attached themselves again. That's why he was having all this pain, and he needed to do this major surgery. So he says, okay, fine. How long is the surgery? He asked the doctor, it's 6 to 8 hours, the second surgery that he's going to have to go through. But before I go, I have to go see the tzaddik, he says to me. I have to see the tzaddik. Now, he does not identify to me in the story who the tzaddik was or where he was, but he needs to see a tzaddik to get a blessing before he does and goes through his surgery. Fine. The story is going on and on. He goes to the tzaddik. The tzaddik tells him he needs to be near there's a gabbai who's holding a sefer Torah, and he needs to be there and to say something with the gabbai who's holding the sefer Torah. Meanwhile, he looks up, and there's like, he says to me, there are like 200 people in the room, and the gabbai holding the sefer Torah is all on the side, and there are all these people behind. There's no way that he can get from where he is to the gabbai who's holding the sefer Torah to be able to say whatever he needs to say. So he says, he's telling me that. So he says, I look up heavenward, he says to me. And I say, Ribono Shel Olam, why do you do this to me? I came all the way here to be able to see the tzaddik to get the bracha for my surgery. What am I supposed to do? I open up my eyes. I cannot explain this, he says. I'm standing right next to the gabbai with the sefer Torah. I don't know how it happened. I'm just telling you, he says. And he quotes to me this person, that person who was with him. I open up my eyes and I'm standing next to him. Ah, wow, he says. I say whatever it is it needs to say. I travel to the hospital for my surgery. They give me the mask that I should fall asleep. And I wake up and it's a half hour later. And I wake up as if I never fell asleep. You know, like not groggy, just I wake up. And I say to the doctor, what happened that you have to wake me up so soon? Doctor says, I can't explain it. We opened you up and everything was healed. All of the ligaments, all of the bone, everything had been back together. So we closed you up and we woke you up. He says, is that a story, Rabbi? That's amazing, I said. Really amazing. Now, maybe it happened. I mean, he's telling me like as if it happened. That's a world. And I'm not going to take by assurance if you believe it, do not believe it, it's a problem. It's a world that a rationalist type thinker cannot relate to. Some of you, again, I don't even want to say, some of you think like that's the most normal thing in the world. Of course, that's like I fell asleep with stories like that, and that's which is great. And there are those who are like, I don't even know how to deal with a story like that. I don't know. What am I supposed to do with that? So I don't have an answer to that question. I'm just saying, here you have a different world. You have a world of Kabbalistic thought in which that story is your everyday run-of-the-mill. That's a good story. And it happened exactly that way. Because the way that we look at the world is not on the surface. There's a deeper meaning. And things which you think are not... There's no such thing as impossible. And that's exactly the way that it works. To a believer, you believe the Ribbono Shel Olam is with you every moment of every day. That's exactly right. That's how it works. And I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just saying to a rationalist thinker who also believes in the Ribbono Shel Olam, who also believes that Hashem is with him every moment of every day, and would still look at that story and say, I'm sorry. So my only goal here is to create the background for what gives rise to controversy amongst the Jewish people. Kabbalah explodes on the scene. It's part of the masses. The masses think along Kabbalistic lines, which by its definition, Kabbalistic is the opposite of rational. It means you're functioning in a different plane, which means it's a different world, so to speak, in which people are functioning in. The whole idea of not learning Kabbalah till you're 40, by the way, comes out of this part of the response to Kabbalah and Hasidim and that idea. Because it wasn't that way originally. All the early Kabbalists were early Kabbalists way before they were 40, and that came out of this. In any case, the next issue that coincides with all of our time is letter E, is the spiritual impoverishment of the masses. So the masses who are now getting it, who are familiar with Kabbalah, who are suffering from another terrible century, who have great resentment against the leadership in the Rabbanim, are also spiritually impoverished, because since they're economically impoverished, what normally follows that is the elite of the elite continued their studies, but they didn't have a yeshiva system the way that we have today. That's not going to be born until the late 1800s. So if you were elite or wealthy, you can hire a tutor and continue your studies. If you were not elite or wealthy, you were working at a very young age, which means that you were not spiritually plugged in, so to speak. So you have masses of people who are now not spiritually plugged in, who are suffering greatly from economic woes. They are suffering always from fear of whether or not be the Russian Tsarist or the Cossacks or anybody else. The complete society of the Ukrainian Jewish community is still destroyed and not yet been rebuilt. Kabbalah is around, and that's the mass that you have at this time. Those things combine to allow to be a very fertile ground for what's going to be called the Hasidic movement. I actually mean to say the Hasidic revolution, and it was a revolution, and it should be identified as such. Let me read you a comment here that Rabbi Wein has, that Hasidus was a revolution. It was a spiritual revival against the upper class and the elite scholars. It literally was a revolution against the upper class. It shifted the focus of Jewish life from scholarship to enthusiasm in Jewish living and prayer. Meaning what had previously been the focus was scholarship, 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 and now there was a shift in focus to enthusiasm. Enthusiasm can be part of anyone's life. Scholarship, not so much. Scholarship requires acumen, it requires wealth, it requires being in the right place at the right time. Enthusiasm is a different thing. So there was a shift. It created a bridge, elevating the mundane to the sublime, infusing life with fervor and emotion, a yearning to cling to God in joy, in love, and in brotherhood. It eliminated the gap between the rich and the poor, the learned and the unlettered, who together under the guidance of the Holy Rebbe soared to spiritual heights. This description sounds good or no good? What do you say? Sounds great, right? Fabulous. Fabulous. I mean, what a beautiful thing, right? Enlightenment. It's going to be enthusiasm. It's going to be joy. It's going to be soaring to spiritual heights. Sounds great. But? Is there a but? There is a but. That's what we're going to get to. In other words, there was a massive response to this. A counter-revolution. The establishment is going to fight back and fight back hard. And for good reason. This description, while all true, is not going to cover everything. And we're going to see, but this is where did this revolution come from? It came from the masses who were spiritually bereft, and it saved to a great extent the Jewish people because of that. It was a salvation. It was a salvation. Let me share with you a parable. There's a story of a king. This parable was told over by Reb Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who was the original Chabad Rebbe, he lived from 1745 to 1813, and he wrote the Baal HaTanya, is it known as the Baal HaTanya, was one of the early Hasidic leaders. So he described there was a king. Well, let me do one more, then I'll tell you this parable. I'll give you one more. There was one other factor, and that was the Enlightenment. The Age of Enlightenment sweeps through Europe in the 1700s. No official date when it started, but it sweeps through in the 1700s. Let me give you the definition that you'll find in the official Webster's Dictionary of what was the period of the Enlightenment. A cultural movement. Now, as I read this, I want you to think about it yourself as the Orthodox Jew reading this definition of the period that you're about to live in. A cultural movement of intellectuals beginning in the late 17th and 18th century Europe, emphasizing reason and individualism rather than tradition. Its purpose was to reform society using reason, to challenge ideas grounded in tradition and faith, and to advance knowledge through the scientific method. Good for the Jews, bad for the Jews. This is bad news for the Jews. The Jews who had been secluded in the ghettos because they were persecuted, part of the Enlightenment was opening up those ghettos, and Jews now experience the world and a changing world. Now, the Enlightenment movement was not aimed against Judaism. It was aimed against the Church and Christianity. But the Church and Christianity share a lot of similar fundamental points with Judaism, and that is tradition. Not necessarily everything is reason. We don't believe in anything. Reason is nice. We use our reason to understand Gemara and Torah as best we can. But at the end of the day, divine wisdom is beyond human reason. And now what society is swept up with is the individual, scientific method. It better make sense. And if it doesn't, somebody made it up. And you don't have to believe it or follow it. And this movement sweeps through Europe. It destroys the church and it destroys a lot of other things along the way. Namely, Torah Judaism. And there are two major movements which come out of the Enlightenment movement. One, which we're going to discuss in a week or two, is the Reform movement. It was the response of the Jews saying, yeah, yeah. We've been secluded and cloistered up in all of these ghettos, and now we're open into the scientific world, and all of these archaic traditions are holding us back, and we can't necessarily prove them scientifically, and the Reform movement is born, which is going to, as its name implies, reform Judaism and fit it into the wave of the society of the time. The second revolution is the Hasidic revolution, which has the exact opposite approach. Whereas the Reform movement shed their former beliefs and practices to fit in with society, the Hasidim are going to become more cloistered, more Jewish, more isolated from society, both of which are a direct response to the threat that they lived through. The threat of this enlightened era, which made it very difficult to remain the way you were. So on the one hand, many, many Jews became Reform, and the Hasidic movement is going to sweep up going in the other direction. The parable that I started is as follows. There once was the king. Many Hasidic mashals begin that way. If you're thinking, why is there always the king? Because there's a king, and there's his son, and the prince, that's us, and lots of things happen between. It's a great way of describing what takes place. There was once a king who had a son who was very dear, precious, and special to him, and the son one day becomes mysteriously ill. Falls into a coma and cannot be revived. All of the king's doctors and all of the king's men rush to the son and are unable to do anything. In an act of desperation, they call a naturalist healer. I don't know what they called him in those days. And he comes and he examines the child and he says, the only cure for this child is taking a 28-carat ruby, crushing it up into a fine powder, add a couple of herbs and water, mix it up, give it to the child to drink, and he'll be cured. And all of the king's advisors hear that, and they say, that 28-carat ruby that he's referring to, there's only one of those that exists, and it's the center of the king's crown. Some of the king's advisors say, the man's a quack, he's a charlatan. You're going to take the most precious gem in the king's crown and grind it into a powder? Because this guy thinks that that's going to heal this child. It's crazy. And another group of the king's advisors say, the king would surely want us to do whatever is in our power to do to save his only son. If that's what it means, we have to do it. And back and forth they argue, some of his advisors saying, this is insanity, and some of them saying, we have to do whatever it takes. Meanwhile, the naturalist healer sees this fighting, sees a child about to die, grabs the crown, pries off the gem, grinds it into a powder, mixes in all that he needs to, feeds it to the child, and the child is miraculously healed. Who's the king? Shem. Who's the child? Jewish people. Jewish people in the 1700s say this is a Hasidic mashal. This is the way that they explain their origins. Fall into a coma. They fall near death. They're dead spiritually. There's nothing there. There's no life. The masses have nothing. And a healer shows up in the form of the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov says, you need to take the most precious gem in the king's crown to save the child. But you can't swallow a gem. You have to grind it up into a powder to make it palatable, to make it swallowable, to make it digestible. And this one argues, you can't do that. You have to do that. You can't do that. And meanwhile, the Baal Shem says, people are dying. And he grabs Kabbalah and the deepest secrets of Jewish thought, and he grinds it into a powder that would be understood by the masses who are otherwise about to fall into a coma and die, and says, take this, it'll give you life. That's how the Hasidim themselves explain the timing, the gift of the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov who comes onto the scene and pumps spiritual life into a society that was dying, into a society that was depressed, into a society that saw really no hope and no future. And if it means grinding up the most powerful, precious, expensive jewel in the king's crown to make it into something that I can feed to a simpleton, then what other choice do you have? You're going to lose him. So they took the deepest teachings and they couched it in terms that were going to be understood, so to speak, by the masses. And from that, the Hasidic movement, the Baal Shem was born in the 1700s, he reveals himself in 1734, and the Hasidic movement is born out of that. By 1780, less than 50 years later, there are over 200,000 Hasidim. If you remember the numbers of Jews that we have around this time, that's nearly 10% of the Jewish world. That's a lot of people. And it only grew from there. And it pumped a spiritual energy back into the people, as that quote that we read from before said. It was a shift from scholarship to enthusiasm, creating a bridge and elevating the mundane to the sublime, cutting out the room between the wealthy and the poor, the learned and the unlettered, and everybody had the ability by attaching himself to the tzaddik to become infused with this element. Okay, so far it sounds pretty good, right? So let's go through what some of the principles were. The Baal Shem was not known as anybody until he revealed himself as the Baal Shem Tov, meaning as a miracle worker, as a healer, as somebody who was selling a new vision. Now, what we're going to stress in a moment, I'll say it right now, is what we're going to find in the Hasidic movement mostly are not innovations or differences, but a different emphasis on that which already existed. And that's very significant because in many of the controversies that we've discussed when we talk about the Karaites or we talk about other groups, certainly Christianity, there was something completely new introduced that put it on the outside of Torah Judaism. What the Hasidim are going to do is they're going to take things from the inside and put it in a different light, give it a different perspective, put it in a different level of significance or importance, but it's from something that I already believed in anyway. You're just making it more important. Well, so that's not coming from the outside or introducing from the outside. It's from within, but it's different than what was. but it's going to revolutionize the way that Jews practice. Let's go through just a couple of the origins of the Hasidic movement. I'm sorry, I'm moving too slow. Let's keep this going. The end of page one. So it sounded, as I mentioned, by the Baal Shem Tov, who's really one of the great mystery men, because we don't know anything about him really before he reveals himself. He was not necessarily known as a great scholar or a Kabbalist. He did not write anything down, nor did he want any of his students to write anything of his down. But he had this reputation of a miracle worker. He healed people through his prayer, and he had great insight into the workings of heaven, the angels, that which is going on. If you remember from last year's course, those of you who were here, many of the stories of the Baal Shem have as part of it of, I saw up in heaven that this or that was supposed to happen to you, so that I needed to do this, that, or the other. Many of the stories have that as of a theme of, this is what's going on in heaven right now, and therefore I need to do this in order to nullify that decree. That concept, you know, we don't even say that about Rashi. We don't say that Rashi knew what was going on up in heaven. We don't say that about necessarily the sages of the Talmud. That was, again, Kabbalah introduced concepts into the realm of the way people would think or talk that allowed for that, but that wasn't necessarily common or new. If you look at the top of page 2, you'll tell me the first thing you think of when you hear this. The Baal Shem in 1746, this is 12 years after he's begun to teach and preach his new concept of Chassidus, which we'll get to in a second what exactly it is. He reports on Rosh Hashanah that he had a mystical vision. Rosh Hashanah 1746, that Mashiach told him that he would come after his teachings have been revealed and spread throughout the world. What does it sound like? Shabtai Tzvi with a twist. Shabtai Tzvi said, I'm the Mashiach. And the Baal Shem says, no one's going to say that. 1746. That's not going to go. But he said, the Mashiach has revealed to me what it will take for him to come. And that's the spreading of this new, I wouldn't call it religion, emphasis on religion. If you're still on a witch hunt for Shabtai Phoenix, which, as we know, 1750s, when the Emden Abishad's country is going to break out, we're still in the midst of this, and you now hear this, that someone is saying that he had a vision that when his teachings are revealed to the world, Mashiach will come. Your reaction is? I read you the statement. It sounded really nice. It all sounded nice. Fervor, emotion, yearning to cling to God, love, joy, brotherhood. Sounded great, right? Well, in 1746, if you were still reeling from Shabtai Tzvi, you might not have thought that it sounded so great. Let's go through some of their basic principles, and we'll come up with other reasons why you might not have thought that it sounded so great. Let's go through. What are their basic principles? Now again, most of the things we're going to learn are not new. It's just going to be a re-emphasis or a different emphasis on what they are. Principle number one, the immanence, the fact that God is everywhere in everything, is a basic principle of Chassidus. Now, at source, we say the pasuk every single day. The whole earth is full of His glory. Correct. Melochol ha'aretz is kivodo. The entire world is filled with His glory. So that pasuk, that's a pasuk in Isaiah. That you can't say that's Chassidus. The pasuk in Isaiah, but it becomes part of a belief system. When you say that the whole earth, and I want to explain exactly what I mean with this, when you say there's no place void of Him, is the teaching in the Zohar. Since God permeates all existence, there is a godliness in all that exists. So that the sacred and the secular are bridged. Because there's really no such thing as secular. There's really nothing that's profane or mundane, because everything is really a manifestation of godliness. It's just in klipot. It's in shells. It's in husk. It needs to be revealed. It needs to be broken so that the holiness can come out. But the holiness is in everything. As the great Kutzker Rebbe said, I have it in the box there. He asked, where is God? He said, wherever you let Him in. Wherever you let Him in, that's exactly where He is. If you don't think He's in the shtender, but He is. You just have to let him into it. Now, I use the Shender as a real example because the Chassidim did. The Vilna Gaon, in his base medrash, if you said there's godliness in here, would call you an idolater. You would say, this is a piece of wood. You're going to give this holiness? There are idolaters who do that. We kill people like that when they claim that that's part of the Jewish belief. There's a form of religion which I'll introduce now called pantheism. The way that the Hasidim taught the presence of God was really, really close to what scholars today would identify as pantheism. Now, what it made for very religious people. If my cow wasn't producing enough milk, I viewed it as a spiritual issue. And I would speak to my Rebbe about it and try to figure out what I'm doing wrong in my spiritual life that's resulting in this. But God permeates everything and everywhere. We'll get back to this concept when we talk about how the Vilna Gaon addressed this. But that was a principle. As far as that goes, I'll just share another story, another parable. The Baal Shem's grandson was a Rebbe by the name of Rebbe Baruch of Mezvitz. Rebbe Baruch of Mezvitz was sitting in his study with some of his Chassidim, and his grandson, Rebbe Baruch's grandson, the great-great-grandson of Baal Shem, comes running in tears, crying his heart out. And the Rebbe says, Rebbe Baruch says, what's wrong? And the grandson says, I was playing hide-and-go-seek with my friends, and it was my turn to hide, and nobody came to look for me. And so the grandfather, the Zaydis, strokes his cheek and says, oh, I'm so sorry, and gives him a kiss on his forehead and sends him off on his way. And when the boy leaves, the Rebbe breaks down into tears, sobbing unconsolably. And as all good stories go, his Hasidim mustered up the courage to say to him, Rebbe, why are you crying? And the Rebbe said, every episode, everything that happens to you is a message from Hashem. And Hashem is telling me, I'm hidden in the world. I'm here, but no one's looking for me. No one is looking, and I'm all by myself. It's a great Chassid d'Shemaisa. It's very spiritually uplifting. And it created a certain world. God's presence is everywhere, and it needs to be searched for everywhere. And that's all good and true. I'm a believer of that. That's right. I'm not saying anything against that. If you take that to an extreme, and you say, V'atah mechayeh es kulam. Anyone familiar with that phrase? It's in Shachris every day. Right before Az Yashir. V'atah mechayeh es kulam. So you give life to everything. Chassidim understood that to mean the you, the spiritual component of you, is what gives life to everything. Everything that exists is because of the you that's in it that gives it its life. In this book, which I'm not going to do justice to, I'm not going to go through it, he brings at length long quotes from Chassidish teachings and then compares it to pantheism teachings, and they're almost the same. And it was a dangerous concept and component that was introduced in terms of how far do you take, is there a difference between the profane, the mundane, the holy, is there a room for separation? Second principle that Chassidim taught was called dveikus. Dveikus is to cleave, to attach to. And they believe that man's ultimate goal in life is attachment or communion with the divine, elevating the entrapped sparks of holiness, and therefore have the ability to exert great influence on heavenly spheres. Man's goal is to achieve and attain dveikus. What is the goal? Come close, cleave, attach yourself to Hashem's presence. Sound good? Question is, how do you do that? Dveikus is the goal. How does one do that? So Chassidim had two primary methods in which a person achieves dveikus. They achieve being able to come close, to touch, so to speak, to be attached to the divine. One is through the tzaddik. through his, the tzaddik's successful dveikus, he's achieved such a level, he therefore serves as a conduit to elevate the regular Jew in his levels of connection. The tzaddik is able, through his greatness, to come down off of his pedestal, gather up the common folk, and serve as a conduit to attach them, to plug them in, so to speak, to the elevation that is required or needed of them. Principle number four is that of religious piety, literally chassidus, which is devotion to God through heartfelt prayer, religious ecstasy, hislahavus, or enthusiasm, and maintaining joyful disposition at all times. Through that sense of religious piety, devotion, heartfelt prayer, religious ecstasy, emotion, enthusiasm, joy, if you live with that and you're connected to a tzaddik, you will achieve dveikus. You will achieve being completely connected and clinging to God, which is their goal. Now, there's a pasuk, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha. It's a verse, it's from the Psalms, serve God with joy. So again, they're not taking something and making it up. There's just an emphasis here. Look at the box from Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan in his book, Hasidic Masters. In the teachings of the Hasidic Masters, one comes across a new way of approaching God and the spiritual. It's not Kabbalah nor philosophy, but experience is the proper way to approach God. You have to experience the joy. You have to experience the passion. Experience the enthusiasm, the heartfelt prayer, the connection, and that will connect you. And they have verses, serve God with gladness, taste and see that God is good, as we say in Shabbos morning from the Psalms as well. What's missing on the list? Study of Torah. It's not through the study of Torah, scholarship, asceticism, or an attitude of fear of sin. Those things are not the primary method of connection, not the primary method of dveikus. There is an attitude, there's an experience. Now again, who is the Hasidic movement talking to? Talking to the masses. Talking to the masses who are not, it's not accessible to them, Torah scholarship. But that which they're saying to them is accessible to them. And it infused the masses with joy, with life, with connection. They became spiritual people, religious people. But it was a shift, it was a focus away from Torah scholarship as the prime method of connection into other forms. The other forms are all well-rooted in Judaism. All of these things, Tveikos, Tzadik, they're all, there's, you could find sources, the Gemara talks about all of them. Question is in emphasis. And the question is primary. And how does one achieve Tveikos and the goal of how and what one needs to accomplish in their life. This revolution, and it was a revolution, this revolution had a very strong form of, I guess, fighting back, so to speak. Strong response. And that was led by the Vilna Gaon. Vilna Gaon was a genius of geniuses. They discuss, if you just want to, you could Google him, Wikipedia. You know, he mastered Chumash by the age of 4. He had memorized Gemara tractates by the age of 7. He had memorized the entire Shas by the time he was a bar mitzvah. By the time he was 15, there was nobody who could teach him anymore. He had mastered Kabbalah and the secular study. They speak about the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu of Vilna, in ways that are beyond recognition. Kabbalah, secular studies, all of Torah. He was just a genius of all geniuses. And the revolution against Hasidim was built on two different things. Number one, it was the coming from the leadership. Whenever any revolution comes against an entrenched group of leaders, those leaders are all usually going to fight back. But here, the fight back was on ideological grounds. It was L'shem Shemayim, for the sake of heaven, because there was a sense that what Hasidus is doing is changing in a very negative way the essence of what Torah Judaism is. So that it wasn't just a group of people that was now engaging the masses, they were corrupting what Torah is all about. And when you feel that Torah is being corrupted, so then you have an obligation and will fight back in a way that's very strong. The Vilna Gaon particularly had very strong beliefs in what he would call the primacy of Torah study. In that Torah study was Talmud Torah keneged kulam. All the mitzvahs in the world do not compare. The Vilna Gaon has comment after comment after comment in all of his works. He wrote on Mishlei, comment on the Chumash. Talmud Torah is keneged kulam. This nothing compares to the value of Torah. The Gemara itself says, davening chaye sha'a. It's momentary. It helps for life in this world. Learning of Torah, chaye olam. It's for the next world. It's eternal. Person, the merit that a person has for mitzvahs, you can lose. Person's behavior can counteract the merit that he gets for mitzvah study, for mitzvahs, says the Vilna Gaon, but Torah study that a person does, nothing in the world can touch it. It's yours forever. And there's a primacy in Torah study, and the Vilna Gaon believed everything was geared towards achieving a level of Torah study. Now the Vilna Gaon was known to cry on Erev Yom Kippur. He had a piece of paper in which he would count up the minutes of the year that he had wasted and was not involved in Torah study. The minutes of the year that he was not involved in Torah study. And here comes a movement that focuses on all sorts of other things. And as we're now going to see, within that re-emphasis or de-emphasis of Torah and re-emphasizing other things, they introduced a number of odd practices that drew the fire of what the Hasidim named the Misnagdim, those who are opposed to us. Because as they begin to spread, the Misnagdim... Misnagdim means to go against. Neged is to go against. So the Hasidim, this is what happens. The Hasidim are a revolution. And then the counter-revolution, they named those against us. They were the ones who, you know, are the new group. And anyone who was opposed to them was called the Misnagdim, those who are against the Hasidim. They're also known as Litvaks, from Lithuania. Let's go over on page 3, some of the perceived and real infractions of the Hasidic movement, which is what really drew the ire. Number one was the many, many similarities to the Shabtai Tzvi movement. Here come the Hasidim, and they come with a lot of Mashiach talk. As I mentioned, one of the reasons why they're spreading themselves around is because they believe, as their leader, the Baal Shem, has said, when my teachings are spread throughout the world and we begin to share love and joy and brotherhood and enthusiasm and intention during davening and all of those things, then Mashiach will come. To an age and generation in the 1700s, that was a bad way to speak. That didn't entice many of the entrenched establishment because they had had enough of people talking about Mashiach. The whole movement was anti-establishment, which, again, a Jewish people suffering from Shabtai Tzvi were trying to re-establish the establishment, not allow more people to come that were anti-establishment. The Hasidim were also itinerant preachers. It was against the concept of a Rav of a Shul. This is one of the things that Rav Feldman and I talk about a lot. You know, you have a Rav of a Shul in the community, they're with the people from, you know, cradle to grave, 40, 50, 60 years. And then what happens is somebody like rides into town, gives some fire and brimstone speech, and then rides out of town. And in his wake, leaves like all these either new ideas or practices. And the Rav is like, well, we don't do that. We've been practicing like this. And then all of a sudden, just somebody comes in and causes a big stir and then rides back out. So to the establishment, the Hasidim were itinerant preachers. That's what they were. They went around very actively preaching and teaching, going from place to place, gathering followers. And that, to the establishment, was also something which was not necessarily welcomed. They also created this, again, within the Sabbatean similarities, this unchallenged power of the charismatic tzaddik, and this great emphasis on Kabbalah. All of those things were red flags that said, that sounds like Shabtai Tzvi. So a lot of the elements of the Hasidim had that, and therefore, for what we'll call the Misnagdim, became very, very opposed to this. Number two, as I mentioned, they were dangerously close to pantheism. This idea of the whole earth is filled with God's glory. The Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu of Vilna, understood that to mean that His providence is everywhere. God is aware and can impact everything in the world at any time. Doesn't mean that He exists in the piece of wood. That's idolatry. It means He's aware of everything at every moment. And in that dispute as to how do you understand the phrase "God's glory fills the world," doesn't mean literally He and His presence fill and give life to every piece of paper and every book, or just that He has providence over everything. So the Vilna Gaon, who felt that it meant that He has providence, someone who said that it means that God fills my paper, is idolatrous. In Hasidus, there's no such thing as evil. Evil doesn't exist. Evil is just sparks of holiness that have become very buried in these klipos, in these shells, and they're desperate for redemption. And the tzaddik is the one who has to descend into the depths of despair, so to speak, to break these shells of these sparks, to be able to bring the holiness back down, which is also very similar to Shabtai Tzvi. Now remember, Shabtai Tzvi, what does he do at the end of his life? And how does everybody who wants to still believe that he's the Mashiach explain that? That it's all part of this messianic process of more Kabbalistic klipos and sinking deeper and deeper and deeper. When you finally sunk deep enough, then the sparks will be able to come out. And now you have this Hasidic movement which is teaching very similar things. There's a very anti-understanding of the Misnagdim heard all of these teachings and saw in Hasidus a lot of the remnants of Shabtai Tzvi. And then you have their infractions, letter C, the improprieties in prayer. This is one of the big issues, and I can't believe it's this late before I actually got to this. Hasidim introduced an entirely new method, a new way of davening. They clapped, they jumped, they whirled around, they twisted, they shrieked, they sang, they danced, they did everything. If you walked into a Hasidish shtibel, if you will, in the early days, you would literally see people running around, shrieking, calling out. Davening times, non-existent. If you weren't ready to daven now, you'll daven later. Because davening is about the communication between man and his God. And if you're not ready now, okay, so Lachal says you have to daven now. But it's more important to connect. And connect in a way that you need to roll. If you need to roll around, you need to roll around. If you need to shriek in joy or in ecstasy, then that's what you need to do. I mentioned in the class on Hasidus from last year, which I'm sure you don't remember, so I'll repeat it, that the Misnagdim would tell a story. The Misnagdim told the story of Napoleon in his travels through Europe, came to the Jewish community, and he saw there were two different shuls in town. And he said, "What's the deal? I got all these religious Jews in two different places." And he looks in, and he sees in what we would call the Litvak, or the Misnagdim shul, the Jews were standing very solemnly in prayer, as if before the king. And he takes a peek into the Hasidus Shasibel, and he sees the gazoo, it's mayhem. And he says, "Those Jews are so clever. They took all the insane people and put them in one room so that they were able to maintain the sanity of everybody else. What a clever religion they have." Now that's how the Misnagdim tell the story. Hasidim don't believe that story ever happened. The Hasidim tell the story that someone once asked the Baal Shem, like, "What are you guys doing? This is so strange how you guys pray." And the Baal Shem says, "I have to tell you a story. Tell you a story. There was once a great musician who came to play on a street corner, and it was just beautiful, it was magnificent. And he begins to play his violin, and then a drummer comes, and the two of them together, it's glorious. And the people are sitting around, and as they begin to play, and they're playing with more and more fervor, the people around are just, they're moved by the music. And then as you get enough people who are moved and swaying, they begin they're just dancing, they're dancing. And a blind man walks by. And he can't see the musician because there are too many people around. And all he sees are all these people dancing around. What's wrong with these people? A deaf man, I'm sorry. A man who's deaf can't see the musician because of all the people. And he can't hear anything. He says, what's everybody doing? So they explain to him, you can't hear the music. If you would hear the music, you would be dancing too. But when you can't hear the music, you think of us as crazy. So Baal Shem would explain, you poor Litvaks. You poor, poor Litvaks. You don't hear the music in life. You're sitting in your shuls, you're solid as a stone, there's no heart, there's no feeling, there's no emotion. You don't hear the music. If you'd just come over, if you'd listen a little bit, and you'd hear the music, you would be dancing too. That's how the Hasidim tell the story. Who's right? I'm not here to judge. I'm not here to say. I'm not here to weigh in on that one. But there were two very different types. The Mishnah says, you stand in davening mitoch kovid rosh, with a heaviness of the head. Literally, with seriousness. You're about to stand before the king. So the Misnagdim looked at what the Hasidim were doing, and they said, childish when they were being kind, blasphemous and heretical and idolatrous when they were being a little bit more harsh. That's how you speak to the King of Kings? You wouldn't speak to your boss? Look at what you're doing. To speak to a king that way? Never. The King of Kings? And then you claim spiritual heights? You claim that you're up in the skies? You know how they looked at the Hasidim? They literally looked at them like children. Like children who had no understanding, no depth, and the Hasidim are there dancing and screaming and rolling and jumping. And then you add to that, and he chronicles this in his book, Shochet, that the Hasidic teachers, the masters, the rebbes, would teach about the union between Klal Yisrael and Hashem. About the marriage, so to speak. And when you would look, and again this is chronicled in part of the early claims that people had against the Hasidim, that it looked like there was all sorts of sexual innuendo in the way the davening looked. In the room, it looked inappropriate. And they would combine that with teachings of unions, and everybody said, the Misnagdim said, this is weird. This is inappropriate, and it's not Jewish. It's not what we believe. It's not how we act, and it's not how we behave. The biggest issue is what I alluded to earlier, which was the perversion of priorities. That was the biggest issue that the Misnagdim had. That the Jewish people had stood from the time the Torah was given until 1700. Over 3,000 years on a principle of Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. The guiding light of the Jewish people, the way to connect to Hashem is through the study of Torah. That's it. It's found throughout the Talmud. The Talmud also mentions that davening is dvarim ha'omdim berumo shel olam, are things which stand in the pinnacle of the world and people don't pay attention to. Yes, it's important, but it never supersedes learning. And when Hasidim came in and emphasized davening over learning, connection over learning, certain mitzvahs over learning, the response to that was, you're fundamentally changing that which is primary. You're taking that which is ikker, that which is primary, and making it tafel, and taking that which is tafel, which is secondary, and making it ikker. And Judaism can't survive, will not survive, if that becomes the norm. Jews will not and cannot survive without the study of Torah being primary. Yeah.
But Torah wasn't open to the masses.
You're raising a fine point. I'm trying to describe why there's a controversy. Torah wasn't open to the masses. It wasn't available. So that's the difference. There's a fine line between saying, since you can't have Torah, let me at least give you this, and saying, this is really the most important thing. As a movement, as an institution. I'm not saying either one, that would have been possible. I'm just saying what became was, this is what is the goal, is Dveikus. Yeah?
Did they follow the same prayer format?
No. And then another thing they did is they changed the prayer format. Those of you who may be familiar with the Nusach Ashkenaz, the traditional siddur that we have in an Ashkenaz siddur like this, the Hasidim adopted what's called Nusach Svard, or the Nusach of the Ari, which is more Kabbalistically aligned. So, now we're used to that. We're used to that you walk into a shul and the first question you ask is like, okay, what kind of siddur do you have? Well, what happens if you were living in the lands of Ashkenaz and you've only ever known one siddur, and then in the year 1734, the siddur is no good anymore. The siddur no longer really connects with the Kabbalah. It's not aligned. And we need a new siddur. And again, we're used to certain things. If you're living in a day and an age where now this new movement comes in, tells you that Torah learning is no longer primary, has all sorts of messianic claims, changes your sitter, you might not be so quick to say, I don't know, it sounds really good. And it begins to spread like wildfire. Literally. Because, on the other hand, the masses didn't have Torah. And it was a revolution against the elites. And it was a revolution against the enlightenment moment. So there are a lot of things happening at once. And it begins to spread. The Vilna Gaon in Vilna in 1772 signs a ban excommunicating the Hasidim. Signed on by dozens and dozens of other leading Rabbanim, because if the Vilna Gaon signs it, then everybody's good to go. Literally excommunicating the Hasidim, banning them from all Jewish life, banning marriage to them because they're no longer considered Jews. And the ban was unsuccessful. Rabbi Wein likes to say, and all of I've heard it many, many times, I think I've mentioned this, the greatest way to perpetuate something is to ban it. I guess we know that in hindsight from its lack of success over history. But that was the response. What are you supposed to do? They declare, you're not Jewish. This is not part of the Jewish religion. The principles you've introduced, the belief in God you've introduced, the sitter you've introduced, the method of connection to God you've introduced, the emphasis you've introduced, this is not what we believe. And there was a series of bans, dozens of bans in all towns started coming out against the Hasidim. And they were none of them were successful, but what they did is they created tremendous, talk about a controversy in Jewish life, tremendous controversy. They both brought in the Russian government, both sides, as it literally, and I'm not going to do justice to what it was like, it was open warfare, a literal open warfare, because the Misnagdim believed the Hasidim were a threat to Judaism, and the Hasidim who believed that they were saving Judaism, believed that the Misnagdim trying to take them out of the picture, were a threat to their existence. And whenever you believe that you're saving God, so you're willing to do things that under normal circumstances you yourself would probably say should never be done. Both sides eventually appealed to the Russian government at different points. In Russia, it was illegal to... almost every single Rav under Russian control was a fugitive. For the reason that in Russia it was illegal to send money out of the country. You're not allowed to send money outside of Russia, and you're certainly not allowed to send money to Eretz Yisrael, which was controlled by the Ottoman Empire, who were the mortal enemies of the Russians at the time. And every single Rav throughout Lithuania, Russia, Poland, regularly collected money and sent it to the small Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. There always was a community in Eretz Yisrael, and every Rav did that, and therefore every Rav was liable to being arrested by the Russians on any given day. Because he was breaking Russian law, and everybody in the Jewish community knew it. And both sides would regularly employ that to the Russian government, claiming that others were doing this, and they were arrested because they were breaking Russian law. The first leader of Chabad, who I quoted earlier, Rabbi Schneur Zalman, was arrested. The Chabad today celebrates the day that he got out of jail. It's still a yontiv on their calendar. He was thrown in jail. Misnagdim were thrown in jail. The Russian government threw in Vilna, the home of the Vilna Gaon. The Hasidim got their ear. They threw out the Misnagdim from all official positions and installed Hasidim in Vilna. Total chaos broke out. Mikvahs were destroyed. Shuls were ransacked. It's hard to describe what took place. But what I've tried to do tonight is explain the two different perspectives on what was taking place to give an understanding of why it took place. Who won? So they both won and they both lost. And I borrow now heavily from Rabbi Wein and his perspective. They were both extremely successful because the reality is, again, as Rabbi Wein expresses it, and I'm quoting him on this, had the Hasidim been allowed to continue the way they were going, the likelihood is they would have exited the Jewish people. The likelihood is they would have, there always are radicals in every movement. And the radicals of what the Hasidim were doing, and I've tried to paint a picture of enough things that put them on the fringe, there were enough radicals who were over the edge, who would have pushed the movement over the edge. Except, there was such pushback from the Misnagdim that what happens when there's such strong, vehement opposition is it sort of pulls everybody back. And it pushed the radicals off and moved the movement a lot closer. So that two generations of Hasidim later, there was a counter-revolution in which the Hasidim, there's a whole group, the Chosid from Lublin, Chabad, created an elitist, Torah study-based Hasidus. So that there's, from within the Hasidic movement, there was a counter-revolution in which the Hasidim said, in our form of Hasidus, it's about Torah study, and it became, Chabad was originally very elitist, philosophically inclined. Today Chabad is totally different, but in its origins, was very elitist in its creation of Torah study as a primary base. Because it shifted. The opposition didn't allow Hasidus to only remain as all love and joy, and you have to be joyous at all times, that's the only form of connection. It brought back Torah into the primacy of what it is. And the Hasidic movement had a major impact on the Misnagdim. A major impact. Karbach Minyan in Litvak Shul. Unthinkable. Literally unthinkable. I think I mentioned this when I gave a class on Hasidus last year. In Ner Yisrael, Ner Yisrael, which is a Litvak yeshiva, founded on the principles of what we would be called Misnagdim. The first time somebody sang Kabbalah Shabbos about 60 years ago, the Mashkiach at the time of the Kromos walked out of the yeshiva and wouldn't daven in the yeshiva for 6 months. Singing in the yeshiva? You're talking to the king. What are you doing? He went down in yeshiva. Today, I was in Israel. Every Shabbos we sing Kabbalah Shabbos. So what happened is, this is the success of the movement. They started very far. The reason why they started is because where the Jewish world was, there was this need for the infusion of life and energy and enthusiasm. When it was created, it was viewed as a threat to Torah Judaism, and it very likely was. Because of the opposition, the majority, the bulk of the Hasidic movement moves, is pulled back to the center. The radicals who would have taken it out are discounted, and the counter-revolution within the Hasidic movement creates elitist Torah-based Hasidus. The Misnagdic communities are forced to deal with all of the complaints that Hasidim had. Cold, there's no life, it's mitzvah from rote. What about the masses? Aren't you going to share your Torah with them? What's going to happen to them? And they are forced to make changes over the centuries. The Musar movement is created in the 1850s. We'll learn about that in the next week or two. The Musar movement is out of the yeshivish world. The yeshiva world of the Misnagdim is going to introduce ethical development and all of the elements of doing things with heart and with emotion, and improving character development, many of the things which were really the bulk of the Hasidic world, and everybody moves a little bit closer to where you are today. If you take out dress, if you were to strip a Chassid of his payas and his bekisha and his frock, and you take a guy in yeshiva and you switch clothes, different, but nothing like what we're talking about in 1750. Nothing like that. They sit side by side in the Mir Yeshiva, learning the same Gemara, davening next to each other. Okay, it's a different nusach of the Siddur. Guess what? I got a different nusach than the Sfarim across the street. That isn't any longer. We have different nuschas. We have nusach Ari, we have nusach Ashkenaz, nusach Sfarim. Okay, there are three different Siddurs that exist in the Jewish world. Fine. This one was passed. This one was passed behind his ears. This one curls his past. Okay. But what represented the movement are still there. I'm not discounting that there aren't differences between the Hasidim. There are. But the gap has been, is far less than what it was. And that was a result of the war, which lasted for about 100 years, until about 1850, when things really simmered down between the two groups, and everybody learned they have to unite against the Russians at that point, which was their biggest issue as opposed to each other. But at the time, and again, that's why I want to go back to the point that I made in the beginning, when you see a chassid today, it's different than the chassid that you saw or that was described when it began. And the reason for that is the result of this controversy. It was a result of the battle that they fought, and it moved everybody. But when it began, and as much again as I read that opening paragraph on page 1 from Rabbi Wein, which sounds beautiful to us today, because it just to us, we read that, yeah, just infusing some more enthusiasm and a yearning to cling to God and infusing life and love and joy and brother. It's all good. When it was created, it brought with it a lot of other things which were not necessarily seen as all good. Tremendous response and backlash to it. And as a result of that, everybody moves a little bit. And we end up in a place in which we are today. But today you still have, when you take the extremes, you know, there are people who you meet who are, they're a litvak, through and through. They don't want any singing Kabbalah Shabbos. They're just not interested in it. They find it distracting, it's disturbing, it doesn't elevate them, it doesn't move them, they just don't like it. They just want to learn. Very nice. That's a litvak. That is your dyed-in-the-wool, straight out of the Misnagda camp, litvak. He doesn't want singing, he doesn't want the joy. His joy comes from Limud HaTorah. He wants to learn, he connects Hashem through his learning, he doesn't like the singing. And for those, I assume most people in this room are not like that. So there's more of a, there's a pure chassidim. They just want the Karbach Minyan, you know, on Tuesday. They want it all the time. It's how they connect. And then you have many people in the middle who, every once in a while, they like it. But different strokes for different folks. You literally had, imagine if you tried to combine a chassidish shul and a litvak shul, you know, like, they just served so differently. As opposed to, I just want to learn. Leave me alone with all this thinking. It's a waste of time. I want to learn. We have this in our shul. If you ever paid attention, when we have a Karbach minion, you know, you have what we call the Zman minion. You have the minion which davens much quicker, and they sit and learn for 20 minutes before they daven Marv on a Friday night, and they're happy. And you have a Karbach minion, and they spend those 20, 25 minutes singing and dancing, and they're happy. And if you made them switch, they'd be miserable. Literally. People who want to be learning, who'd be forced to sing and dance, like, this is a waste of time. And those who want to be singing and dancing are like, the learning is great, but I need to dance. And welcome to the world of the Jewish people. Welcome to the world of the Jewish people. Hashem in His great wisdom has given us chassidim, He's given us the litvak, the misnagdim, and He's given us, as in our world, the ability to combine both. And you find the niche as to what allows them to work. There are different ways of expressions. When chassidim started, the misnagdim viewed them as a threat. They did. They saw them as a real threat to the existence of Judaism. And now 250 years later, you know, the movement is alive and well. What Hitler did, destroyed it, and they've been rebuilt stronger than ever. Unbelievably strong. The clash still exists today in Israel. For the heart and soul of what the land of Israel will look like from a religious perspective, it still exists today. Between the yeshiva world and the Hasidic world, now we have the Dati Lumi world, there's still a struggle today that's for the heart and soul of the Jewish people. And I don't know what the result of that's going to be, if it's going to figure out a way to coexist, but there still is today, much less in America, we don't have it, but in Israel today, it's still there, and it's in full force. In terms of how things will look and culture that's been created. But anyway, that's a little bit of the great controversy. Again, if you're interested in any way, this book is really just phenomenal. I highly recommend it. It's a great read, and it'll give you tremendous insight into this period of time and a very objective way into the two different sides and how they looked at it. And I hope that I did it justice in terms of trying to describe that. All right, have a great day. Stay safe over this next week.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it, so that he can continue that site.